Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the February 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. With me this month are Phil Broadwith, Mike Brown and Laura Howes, and they're here to relate how relativity powers your car, the discovery of a new magic bullet for HIV, it's an antiviral that only activates in HIV-infected cells, and a new way to measure the amount of garlic in food, so you'll know better in future what not to eat before a hot date. I'll also be talking to the man behind an initiative to harness for public good the power of the world's PCs.
Say you're looking at drug screening. The actual computation you need to do only takes a minute, but you've got to look at a million different combinations of molecules. If you can only do that on one computer, it takes a million minutes. On the other hand, if you have access to a million computers, it takes on the order of 1 minute to do the entire problem.
Joseph Jasinski from IBM will be explaining the workings of the World Community Grid later in the programme. I'm Chris Smith, and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And putting the key into the programme's ignition for us this month, and please excuse the car-related introduction, it is relevant. Phil.
Well, Chris, the battery that actually starts your car is full of lead and sulfuric acid. Lead is a very heavy element, and a peculiar property of heavy elements is that because they've got very large nuclei, they accelerate the electrons around them extremely fast. So those electrons end up going at a significant fraction of the speed of light. And Einstein's theory of relativity says that that has some peculiar effects on their mass, which has very strange effects on the chemistry of these heavy elements.
So the faster something goes, the heavier it gets because it's got more energy.
Yep, that's exactly right, Chris. That phenomenon is the same one that makes gold a peculiar yellow colour rather than the sort of silvery colour of most other metals. It's also one of the reasons why mercury is a liquid rather than a solid.
And this gives the car battery some of its peculiar electrical effects.
Well, yes, Chris. What Rajiv Ahuja and Pekka Pico at Uppsala University in Sweden did was some theoretical quantum mechanical calculations about how much of the voltage of a lead-acid battery is down to these relativistic effects. And it turns out to be quite a lot. The voltage of a single cell of a lead-acid battery is about 2.1 volts. And the Swedish group's calculations say that 1.7 to 1.8 of those volts is down to these relativistic effects.
So most of it?
Yeah, pretty much most of it.
How did they do that?
The actual effect in terms of chemistry of what's going on with this relativity is that it changes the energy levels of the different orbitals within the atoms. And by doing quantum mechanical calculations of those energy levels and how they're affected in all of the chemical species present in the battery, they worked out what contribution that has to the potential.
Scary stuff. Einstein was right, and he's even driving my car today. Thank you, Phil. Now, Mike, sticking with the electric theme, but not quite car batteries, things you can wear, silk. Now researchers are turning this into a transistor.
Yes, that's right, Chris. So researchers in Sweden and Spain at the Linköping University and Biomedical Centre in Sweden and the Centre of Electrochemical Technologies in Spain have devised silk transistors that you can actually weave into clothing.
So the wearable computer comes a step closer.
Yeah, that's right. So at the moment, transistors, which are semiconductors that amplify or switch electronic signal, are printed onto hard substrates, such as your motherboard in your computer. But in our technological age, we want flexible transistors that, you know, maybe can power your mobile phone or your iPod while you're walking around. So the place to put them is in your clothes.
OK, so what have they done and how have they done it?
So the team have dipped silk fibres into a conducting polymer, and then they've woven them together. And at the place where the fibres meet, they've put an electrolyte solution on, which then hardens, and that means the fibres actually talk to each other. So when you apply a potential to one of the fibres, you can actually then change the voltage and current in another fiber. So it's acting like a transistor in the clothes.
What about if you do this with swimming trunks? Is there a danger they might short out? I mean, if you go in the sea or maybe even have an accident, perhaps, or just wash your clothes, what's the impact of water on this?
Well, at the moment, the research is mainly in the kind of weaving them into a fabric, and then they're going to think about water and how that affects it at a later date. But I'm not sure going swimming would be a very good idea. The team also say that in the future they want to integrate the structures into biological tissue as well. So that's the next step on.
So no silk speedos yet. You're all right for the time being, Mike. In a moment, we'll hear about a potential new breakthrough in treating HIV. But before that, here's a technology that's helping researchers all over the world to solve big scientific problems. And that's by harnessing the power of the desktop PC. It's called the World Community Grid. It's been built by IBM, and Joe Jasinski is one of the directors on the project.
The idea is that there are lots of scientific problems in the world that, if they were solved properly, could benefit humanity in a general way, benefit society, but they require a lot of computing power. And frequently, the researchers who are trying to solve these problems at universities and other not-for-profit research institutions don't have access to enough compute power. So the idea behind the World Community Grid is to get ordinary citizens to volunteer time on their personal computers with no effect on the actual use of the computers. What we do is we use the time when you're not actually using your computer, and we assign problems from the projects that we are currently working on, led by academic and not-for-profit researchers, to your computer over the Internet. So your computer gets a little bit of code. It comes as a screensaver. And when you're not using your computer because you've got off to get a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or something, your computer merrily sits around doing these calculations. When it's finished its calculation, it sends its result back to what we call the head node, or the machine that organizes the grid, and asks for another problem. The reason this can be very powerful is we have about 1.6 million machines on the grid currently. And so think about this. If you are a researcher and you need to do a computation that only takes maybe a minute on a personal computer, but you need to do a million different use cases. So say you're looking at drug screening. The actual computation you need to do only takes a minute, but you've got to look at a million different combinations of molecules. If you can only do that on one computer, it takes a million minutes, which is quite a long time, actually. On the other hand, if you have access to a million computers, it takes on the order of 1 minute to do the entire problem. Now, there's communications that have to be done and stuff, so it doesn't actually just take 1 minute. But you can reduce a problem that would take years and years of computation on a single machine to maybe a few hours or a few days on a grid of 1.5 million machines.
So it's kind of similar, I suppose, to what you do when you type a search into something like Google, and they're distributing the problem over many, many, many linked computers. And this huge array of computers dramatically enhances the computing power. We've seen similar with SETI at home and things like that, haven't we? So how is your thing different? Is it the first?
No, so it's not the first. The reason it's different, and SETI at home is an example of one of the first of these kind of cycle stealing or cycle borrowing grids, if you want to call them that, things that work in the background on a computer that doesn't belong to the person who's using it. So Google's a little different, right? They have dedicated machines that are actually being used to search the Internet full time. This is kind of an idea of citizen science, right, where you're contributing time on your machine that you're not using to solve some problem that is of interest to you but is being actually coordinated by some researcher. So we weren't the first. What differentiates us from all other grids of this type that we're aware of is that what IBM has done is set up an organization which actually runs the grid, but we don't have a particular problem that we ourselves want to solve. So we recruit members, we recruit principal investigators who want to solve problems. We work with the principal investigators to, first of all, assess if their code can be run on the grid in an effective way. We have an external board of scientific advisors who decide whether the project meets the requirements of our community, which is to produce some result that will benefit mankind. And we have a technical committee that sort of assesses, you know, is this a good use of the grid and will the problem actually run on the grid? And once we've done that, we work with the principal investigator to get the code up and running and essentially run the experiments for them and provide the data back.
And what sorts of problems are you solving? Because people will probably find it easier to understand if you can give some tangible examples of the kinds of things you're grappling with using this, what sounds like a very powerful tool.
Yeah, so as an example, we have a project called Fight AIDS at Home, which is a project where a group at University of California, San Diego, is trying to find new antiretroviral therapy, so new anti-AIDS drugs, by doing a computation that is called a docking computation. So they have a model of what the protein is in the AIDS virus that they're trying to affect. They have what's called a library, so a vast compilation of potential compounds that might have a beneficial effect on stopping the AIDS virus from doing what it wants to do. And they essentially need to find out which of those compounds are more likely to stick to this protein compared to other compounds. So it's a very simple, what's called a docking calculation. It can be run very well on a single PC. You just need to screen millions and millions of pairs of proteins and molecules. Another example has to do with analyzing the results of gene sequencing experiments. So we've worked on a project called Nutritious Rice for the World, where the gene sequence of different strains of rice has been determined. And if you can now do simple computations to understand the function of the different genes in the rice genome, you can do what's called marker-assisted hybridization, which means that you can pick genes that impart beneficial properties like resistance to certain kinds of disease or tolerance for being overly waterlogged. And you can hybridize using normal hybridization methods that agriculturalists have used for years, new strains of rice with a high probability of getting something that has improved yield or improved resistance to disease.
I mean, it sounds absolutely terrific. But what hurdles did you have to overcome in actually setting it up in the first place? Because it sounds, the way you tell it, terrifically simple, but I'm sure it hasn't been so.
So the technology is not that challenging. We actually have used a number of different kinds of grid agents. We currently run on Boink, which is a well-known open source grid technology. The real challenge is in getting a community together, because obviously this thing doesn't work unless people volunteer their machines. So if you want to participate in the World Community Grid as a member, you go to a website called worldcommunitygrid.org, all one word, and you essentially register yourself so we know who you are, and you can join a team if you want, you can form a team, and you download a screensaver. And then you tell us if you want to work on a specific problem, we can assign your machine only to that problem. If you're generally open to working on any of our problems, we'll assign whichever problems we need more compute power on at a given time to your machine. It's very easy. You get some really pretty screensavers that you can show off and show people how your computer is saving the world. So it's really fun if you're interested in science at all. The other thing I should mention is that each principal investigator produces a web page about their project that's written in plain English, so that you can understand what kind of problem you're solving and what progress is being made. And we send out regular newsletters about, you know, what problems have been finished and what projects are starting, and updates when the results are made public as to where you can find those.
IBM's Joe Jasinski. And the address, again, if you'd like to contribute some computing power to the project, is worldcommunitygrid.org. You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how to cheaply turn waste CO2 into salts and how sea urchins can keep their teeth sharp. We look at all the hardest-hitting stories here. But first, a new way to selectively hit AIDS-infected cells. Laura.
HIV is obviously a major health problem, and one of the things that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been doing is a lot of grand challenges about HIV and how people can solve it. Craig Cruz and his group at Yale University in the US have taken some of that money and have been looking to make a smart drug that will kill the cells that HIV is in without harming the rest of the body.
Because obviously one of the big problems with AIDS drugs is that, yes, this antiretroviral therapy involving combinations of drugs is very effective, but the side effects from some of those drugs are terrible, aren't they? And you also get resistance over time. So we're always looking for new ways to come up with new drugs.
Sure. So what Cruz is actually looking at is, instead of fighting the virus, he's looking to try and kill the cells that the virus lives in, the reservoir that it is in inside the body, and actually trying to get rid of the illness that way.
How are they doing that?
Well, so they've got this drug. It's called a protease inhibitor. And protease inhibitors work and kill cells. They're cytotoxic. And a lot of people have been using these for cancer therapies, including Cruz himself. What they've done is modified one of their cancer-killing, cell-killing molecules so that it's only activated by the HIV virus itself.
Oh, cunning. How?
To get the protease inhibitor to work, it needs to get inside a small room and essentially pull a trigger. What they've done is added a large steric group onto their drug that can only be removed by a protein, an enzyme that the HIV excretes itself. So it's a bit like if you were trying to get into a room with your umbrella up. You end up dropping, if you drop the umbrella, you can get in much quicker.
And it's the HIV's presence, the protease in the HIV, that effectively removes that umbrella and the drug goes in.
Yeah, so the umbrella is held by a linker with a specific few amino acids that is specific for the HIV protease 1 enzyme.
Sounds good, but the problem is there are a number of constraints with this. One of them being, of course, it won't get the virus which is resident in the genome, because HIV goes into the genome and lurks there as a provirus, doesn't it? And periodically comes out from there, so
sure.
It won't get to that.
So one of the things that Cruz is talking about is having to actually activate the virus. So that when it's sitting there hiding in your genome, you'd have to actually slightly activate it, start it working, start it producing the enzymes and the proteins that it would do naturally. And once it does that, then your drug can be activated and kill the cells that it's resident in.
What about, two important questions with any sort of new drug or anything. One is safety. Do these agents work in the body? Are they biocompatible, first and foremost?
These agents are biocompatible. The actual drug that they've modified is already in phase 3 clinical trials for cancer research. So there shouldn't be too much of a problem with it interacting badly in the body. And indeed, it shouldn't sort of kill cells that aren't containing HIV.
And my next question was going to be, well, what's the timeline? Because normally when a drug is in trial, you're looking at 10, 15 years. But if it's already in trials and they're at an advanced stage for, albeit another disease, that should speed things up.
Hopefully, if they can prove that their concept works, which they have, and that that's not a problem, the fact that it's already in phase 3 clinical trials could mean that it's going to be developed a lot quicker.
OK, Laura, thank you. We'll keep an eye on that, because obviously HIV, very big problem with millions of people every year catching it. 7,000 deaths a day and 7,000 new infections with HIV every day. So anything that can be done to mitigate that is very important. Now, Philip, sticking with a very small, but not quite as small as a virus, microfluidic pinball is on the agenda. Tell us about this one.
Lots of us have fond memories of pinball machines, a little ball being bounced around on the table. But what Dieter Trau at the National University of Singapore is doing is using that kind of pinball idea to develop a way of making layers on the outside of oil droplets using polymers so that they could be used to deliver drugs or do various other kinds of things.
So this is a bit like if you've got a suite. These sweets that you can get, which have got multiple layers around the outside, and you want to put those layers on. But this is doing that at a tiny scale for droplets that could be drug molecules.
Yeah, Chris, it's a bit like a gobstopper, as you say. So what these guys have done is take a sort of channel which has three parallel streams of liquid running through it in very straight streams in a kind of laminar flow. Two of those on the edges are the polymers that they want to use to coat the droplet, and the third one in the middle is a kind of washing solution that removes any residues of polymer that haven't stuck. The pinball part comes in because in diagonal lines throughout the channel, they have tiny little pillars. So when you push an oil droplet into the stream, it gets pushed along by the streams of polymers flowing, but the pillars divert it across between the different streams. So it goes through one polymer stream, picks up a coating of the polymer, goes through the middle wash and gets rid of any sort of excess and cures off the polymer. Then it goes into the second polymer on the other side, drops down onto the next set of pillars and goes back across. So every diagonal line of pillars, you get another layer of each polymer. So you can build up as many layers as you want, all continuously, have a continuous stream of droplets.
And you could use this to make, say, smart drugs then. So these will be drugs with all these different layers on, which will uncoat at a certain rate, so they are delivered to certain bits of the intestine, or they stay in circulation for a certain amount of time before they activate, that kind of thing.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems with drug delivery is that drug molecules are often very fat-soluble rather than being water-soluble. It's one of the big problems with medicinal chemistry. You can find a drug that's fantastically active, but it doesn't dissolve in water, so you have real problems getting it into the body in the first place.
What I don't quite get, because I can see that you've got three parallel trains of fluid there, and you've got these pillars running across them. So why do the little things that you're introducing to get coated, why do they transfer between the different fluid channels, but the fluids themselves don't get perturbed into each other and mix up?
I think that's partly to do with the way that the channel is designed. You have to have a very straight channel, but also to do with the difference in viscosity and different surface properties of the different of the polymers and the washing stuff. If you get the properties of those right, then they don't mix when they come into contact with each other. But you can push the droplets through the interface, and that's where you get the coating.
Thanks, Phil. To capturing carbon now, and here's a man who's come up with a concept called SkyMine, which involves electrolysing brine to make sodium hydroxide and using that to capture the CO2 in a flue stream.
My name is Joe Jones, CEO, president, founder, and inventor of the SkyMine process that we use here at Skynet Corporation to capture carbon dioxide from large stationary emitters like power plants and the biggest emitters and the biggest problem in the industry. The process begins with taking very ordinary salt water, placing the salt water on one side of the membrane, and then electrolyzing it. Hydrogen gas forms on one side of the membrane, chlorine gas forms on the other side, and on that same chlorine side, it forms caustic soda, which pours off the bottom. One can then take the caustic soda, and it's similar to drain cleaning products around the world. You take that hard lye and combine it in a spray tower with the carbon dioxide flue gas escaping a power plant or a cement plant, and it first forms washing soda in one column, and then we use a secondary column where it's mixed again with carbon dioxide under the right conditions, and it forms baking soda. The hydrogen and chlorine gases then go off and displace other means of making hydrogen from natural gas, and we're making the chlorine at such low energies that we're able to displace higher, larger carbon footprint means of making chlorine. At the same time, this process accomplishes a full scrub of the acid gases, sulfur dioxides and nitrous oxides, those acid rain gases that people read about, and eliminates the spread of mercury and lead and arsenic and antimony and all the bad things that are otherwise in flue gas.
So what can you actually work with? Can a power plant literally just send you what's coming out of the furnace, or do you need something which is relatively clean already?
Other techniques that use amine-based chemicals to capture CO2 and then re-release it and pump it in the ground, they actually require a pre-scrubber. But our process is its own scrubber.
What's the actual business model here? You would take the chlorine and hydrogen, as you've said, you offset some of the costs selling it. The bicarb that you make is pharmaceutical grade, very high purity, but there's only so much chlorine, so much baking soda and so on that people around the world need. What's the actual business case here for doing this?
We've performed studies in our work for the Department of Energy grants that we've achieved that showed that we can proliferate up to 25 plants in the U.S. and maybe four times around the world on the very first intermediate products, which are baking soda and hydrochloric acid. After that, you can continue to make other products from those intermediates, such as sodium carbonate, and then various grades of calcium carbonate. Aragonite is a form that is used, a very low iron limestone that's used in the manufacture of plate glass. Very dear, but provides good profits. Then there's precipitated calcium carbonate, which makes up about 40% of all the white paper that we use. And then you start getting into the lower grades. So your point is well taken. Eventually you run out of markets. But the business model is intent upon using those profits to go use the invisible hand of economics to drive the marginal cost of CO2 capture to its lowest point. But thereafter, when we're doing it beyond the extended markets and capturing carbon, you're doing so at the least marginal cost per ton captured.
That's the business model, though. But what about the energy model? If I'm running a power plant, I roughly know how much energy I'm going to extract from my fossil fuel. If I staple on your technology, what's the energy cost to me doing this?
One of the main thermodynamic laws can be translated as you can't do anything without having an energy penalty. And in this case, when you convert a gas of CO2 into a mineral, carbonate or bicarbonate material, yes, there's always an energy penalty. The question then becomes, well, how bad is the energy penalty compared to other techniques? Amine and pump in the ground technologies, which are the current world standard for that, will claim 25%-ish energy penalties against coal, and then critics will state that those run up into the mid 40%. we're able to have been able to demonstrate in the field 27% like numbers, and in laboratory with other techniques beyond what we're currently deploying commercially, we're seeing things that get down into the low 20% quite well.
So if I pass my flue gas through your process and it costs me about 25% in terms of the energy offset, will I see all of the CO2 removed from my flue stream through that process?
The current commercial plant that we are have just designed to remove 75,000 metric tons of CO2 does so at a 92% CO2 strip rate.
And is this ready to hit the marketplace? Have you got sufficient data now from the pilot plants to be able to start approaching the big emitters, not just in the US but worldwide, and say, right, do you want this?
We have completed the design and now have a plant ready to build at the 75,000 ton per year scale, starting construction this year and completing and going industrial scale, I mean, putting out chemicals and capturing carbon in the second half of 2012.
But 75,000 tons is not a huge amount of output, is it? I mean, for a really big power plant, that's an afternoon's busy afternoon's work, isn't it?
That's certainly true. But on another point, that happens to be the level at which the U.S. government has set the reporting limits for same. So persons below that limit are not required to report, and those above are. So it looks like a good regulatory threshold to build a one-module plant, and then for persons who require greater to just replicate modules and be able to scale it linearly, literally dialing it almost by the electron to what the customer needs.
Joe Jones from Skyonic, who's sequestering CO2 in salts. And talking of salts and minerals, why doesn't biting into them blunt your teeth? Laura.
Sea urchins, those spiky things that you don't want to step on, actually have...
Have you stepped on one?
I have. It's quite painful.
Yes, it is, isn't it? And they look fearsome underwater when you see them with these
giant
long spines
giant
sticking
spikes,
off. And you think,
yes.
Oh, they look lethal. Won't step on those. And you probably do. But yes, go on. So they don't just have spines.
They
also
don't
got
just
teeth.
Have spikes. They also have teeth. Sharp teeth that they can chew through rock. And this is quite an interesting property because the rock is made of calcium carbonate and so are the teeth of the sea urchins. And no one's ever really managed to work out how the teeth of the sea urchin can bite through rock and not get dull. But now scientists at the University of Wisconsin, in collaboration with some colleagues in Israel, have worked it out.
Go on, reveal all.
Reveal all. The calcium carbonate in the teeth of the sea urchin is actually made into plates or filaments, and these are layered up, stuck together with a sort of nanocrystalline matrix, a bit like cement. So you've got layers stuck together with a sort of cement. And what they've shown is that because of this cement, they can shear off the layers at predefined places. And this means that whenever it's starting to get dull, one layer flakes off and you've always got a sharp edge on your teeth.
How did they find that? Was that just an ultra-structural study? They sort of took the teeth and looked at them fine and in much detail just to see what was in them?
Yeah, so they just used tunnelling electron microscopy to look at the structure and see how it broke down. So they actually then did some work actually trying to get the teeth to bite things and seeing how the layers flake off.
It's good to have some research you can get your teeth into. Excuse the pun. What do we think we could actually do with this piece of research, though, apart from the fact that it's academically interesting how these animals have evolved to do this? But is there any other aspect of industry, chemistry, engineering which could be informed by this?
Well, obviously, as you say, the academic interest is fascinating. The fact that we're still learning things from nature, I think, is really great. But actually, yes, a lot of people are looking at nanomaterials. Self-sharpening nanomaterials would be great for a lot of engineering materials sort of research.
Well, I've already used my hopeless pun to say research you can get your teeth into, but here's something you don't want to get your teeth into. Too much garlic, Mike, because you might end up picking up a bit of a whiff, but that's precisely what the invention you're going to tell us about is designed to do.
Yes, that's right, Chris. So a team of chemists at the University of Oxford have designed an electrochemical sensor to tell us how much garlic is in a product.
Is this with the dentistry market and a sort of halitosis detector, kind of fresh breath detector in mind, or is this purely for food and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's purely for the food industry, so that there's more consistency when sauces are made and things like curries. Because at the moment, the industry uses human tasters, which isn't very consistent, because obviously one person has a different taste to another, and therefore the strength of garlic can vary in products.
So what does the new technique involve?
What Richard Compton and his team have done is put garlic puree in a solution of bromide ions. Then they've created an electrochemical cell there by basically putting a current through the solution. The current then changes the bromide ions to bromine, and then the dialyl sulfide in garlic, dialyl sulfide gives garlic the strength. The dialyl sulfide then reduces the bromine back to bromide ions, and at that stage you get a peak in current, which then is recorded, and that gives you the strength of the garlic.
So the peak is proportional to how much garlic is there.
Yeah.
But when I did chemistry at school, we did all these funky reactions where you could take an alkene and some bromine water in the dark and it would decolorise. This was a test for an alkene double bond. Well, what if there's some double bonds in other molecules that creep into the mixture then? Why don't they end up muddying the water?
Yeah, that's kind of the cool bit, really, in terms of what's going on. Because it's the electrochemical sensor and the reaction is very, very fast, the bromine doesn't have a chance to react with any carbon bonds that are actually in the solution. And therefore, all you get is the bromine being reduced to bromide.
Have they actually tried this industrially yet, though? Have they taken a jar of Patax and fed it to the system in order to see if it really does work? Or at the moment, is this a kind of ideal conditions in a lab? We don't know if this is really going to be scalable yet.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they've used garlic puree in a lab. So, no, it hasn't been scaled up yet. But in the future, it might be putting taste testers out of a job.
Oh, dear. But at least they'll be able to kiss someone with a clean conscience. Thank you, Mike. Now, stay there, though, because you can tell us why this is a very important year, because it is, of course, the International Year of Chemistry. So what have you got planned?
So the International Year of Chemistry is a celebration of chemistry. It's this year because it coincides with the centenary of Marie Curie's Nobel Prize. So it celebrates everything to do with chemistry and also women in chemistry as well.
And how are you at Chemistry World going to do that?
Well, at Chemistry World, one of our sections of the magazine this year is about heroes of chemistry. So we're inviting Nobel laureates and chemistry luminaries to write in and give us their chemistry heroes and talk about them. All the editorial team are going to do the same thing on our blog, and we're inviting you to go to www.chemistryworld.org/blog and get involved. Just write a blog about who your chemistry hero is.
And can we ask you to venture who your chemistry hero is?
I won't tell you who my hero of chemistry is.
Can we have a hint?
Okay, I'll give you a hint. As a child, when I was at school in the chemistry lab, I used this bit of equipment that this chemistry hero invented a lot.
Now I'm struggling to work out who invented the fire extinguisher, but maybe they'll come up next time. But you can find out by reading Mike's Hero of Chemistry on the Chemistry World blog, which is at
chemistryworld.org/blog.
Thanks, Mike. That's it for this month. Thank you to our contributors, Phil Broadwith, Laura Howes and Mike Brown, and our guests, Joe Jasinski and Joe Jones. Production this month was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. Thank you for your company. We'll be back with more top chemistry next time. Until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.